From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a new state budget paves the way into another uncertain year. Also, women in the legislature get used to sexist statements.
What I think I haven't been used to is leadership that is not only will say things that are offensive, but then doubles down.
Also, Pfizer vows to speed up production for COVID vaccines.
They started out, it took 110 days per batch. They are on track to get that down to 60.
And undocumented immigrants get shut out of federal COVID aid.
If there's a mixed status family, one parent is a citizen, for example, and the other one is not, it doesn't matter how many kids they have born here, they don't get the stimulus.
Stay with us. Those stories and more coming up this hour. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what Pfizer is doing to try to cut COVID vaccine production time in half.
Those batches of vaccine were started around Halloween. So it is speeding up, but it's not instantaneous.
That's coming up in the second half of our show. But first, we've got some state budget news for you. The last time Gretchen Whitmer produced her budget, it was drafted under the extreme duress of the early COVID pandemic. It was done with a big one-time infusion of cash from the federal government. This year could be a very different budget process for the governor. She suggested on a call with reporters today that it's hard to overstate the importance of what's going to happen in Michigan this budget cycle.
Hi, April.
Does this look very much like a normal year's budget?
Well, I'm not sure what that means anymore. You know, we're in the second year of budgeting for a pandemic. Last year's was focused more on the early response to the pandemic. Now we're focused more on the ongoing response and maybe a return to some version of normal, getting back to school, helping businesses recover. One other thing that's different is that instead of building in increases, this is kind of a flat budget. It's barely inflationary, and it's got a lot of one-time sources of revenue. So it's not a lot of ongoing new programs.
Rick, the package that the governor has put forward, how reliant is it on what Republicans have been working on in the legislature? It's no secret that they've been pretty far apart in the past on how money should be spent during the pandemic.
Well, it certainly was not a kumbaya budget. It certainly was not a kumbaya budget in that respect. But certainly the governor is taking into account at least some of the wishes and expectations of Republicans in the legislature. And Republicans expressed some hope that they could find something, some places to work together on. And I think probably the two biggest aspects of that are helping with business recovery and getting students back into school, into classrooms. And obviously the first step in that is getting the federal COVID aid dispersed. And that's where they're at loggerheads at the moment.
Right. Do you know where that stands right now? Again, this is the federal aid package that was passed in the last session of Congress.
Mm-hmm. And the governor is looking for the legislature to basically appropriate the money, give the governor permission to spend it. And she says that's what's holding up dispersing that money. And Republicans, they're trying to set some conditions on that. They don't want to give her just, I guess metaphorically, a blank check to allow that to happen. They want some specific metrics on when schools will be opened, when schools would be closed. They want some assurances that restrictions won't be reimposed. The governor does not want to give up her ability to be nimble and make adjustments to deal with what's happening with COVID and what's happening with the economic fallout of the health crisis.
You mentioned there's some aid to schools that the governor and the legislature are likely to agree on. Can you quickly run us through what she's proposing in terms of direct aid, either to workers or businesses?
Sure, that she wants, one of the things that Governor Whitmer, like her predecessors, have been very interested in is getting more skilled workers into the workforce, people with associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, or professional certifications. And she is making that part of her budget as a reward to frontline healthcare workers, for example, giving them assistance to go to a community college and get some kind of professional certification. So that's one example.
Right. Listen, if I can just ask you about one other thing, Rick. The Senate's majority leader, Mike Shirkey, made some comments to local Republican Party members in his district. Comments about the January 6th insurrection in Washington, D.C., and some comments about Governor Whitmer. And the things that he was saying are things that a lot of people would not say if they knew that they were being recorded. And all of this came spilling out this week. This is a weird question, but do you know if the Senate's majority leader will face consequences from his own caucus?
From his own caucus, probably not, certainly in the short term. I think the question is whether or not Republicans will see fallout from the majority leader's commentaries. And remember, this is not the first time he stepped in it. And whether or not they're going to require either a change in behavior, if not a change in leadership. But right now, I don't think that there's a lot of disagreement between Republicans and their majority leader.
Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief in Lansing for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thank you, Rick.
You bet, April.
As we mentioned, Mike Shirkey's choice of words in describing his opposition against Gretchen Whitmer in politics has once again made headlines. Just quoting here, what he told the Hillsdale County Republican leaders he met with was, "We spanked her hard on the budget, spanked her hard on appointments. We did everything we could constitutionally do." Use of sexist language has been a hallmark of Governor Whitmer's time in office. State Senator Stephanie Chang says it has to stop. Senator, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, you know, the news this week, in part, is that Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey was in this conversation with a couple of Hillsdale County Republicans. And the language that he used to defend his record in working with Governor Whitmer was, quoting here, "We spanked her hard on the budget, spanked her hard on appointments. We did everything we could constitutionally do." I have to say, I think that's the first time I've run across a reference to spanking in public discourse in 25 years of journalism. How did the phrase he chose land with you?
Well, it was disturbing, disappointing. I will say it's getting to a point now where, as shocking as everything is, in some ways, it's kind of like nothing really surprises us anymore, which is really sad to say. But it's a repeated pattern, I think, that we're seeing of just complete disrespect towards women. And I've always tried to find ways to work with people and to try to understand where people are coming from. I'm an eternal optimist, but Lansing is a pretty weird place right now. And I think that, comments that are just so blatantly disrespectful and sexist, it's really disappointing. And it's something where, you know, we really should demand that all of our elected officials act appropriately. So it's extremely concerning.
I want to hear more about your experiences working in Lansing, but something you just said really struck me. You said Lansing is a pretty weird place right now. Tell us more about what that's like. Is there something in the moment that you think has stripped people's normal barriers about the way they talk to each other?
Well, I think that, you know, so I've been in the legislature now for over 6 years. There's always been partisanship, right? Like, that is not new. I've served in the minority as a Democrat all 6 years. I'm used to losing on a lot of issues and winning where I can on bipartisan things where, you know, with a lot of hard work you can get done. But what I think I haven't been used to is leadership that is not only will say things that are just so wrong and offensive, but then, you know, doubles down and not actually show any true regret or learning or understanding about the implications or the impact of what is said.
What do you think that's about?
I wish I knew. I really I've always known, you know, especially through my time here in the legislature, I think people do come from different parts of the state where there are just completely different realities and different ways of interacting, I suppose. But what I think, you know, just as human beings, as adults, is some, you know, just the expectation that when you say something that harms someone, to try to understand that harm and to try to learn about it, and then to apologize in a way that is real, that shows that you know what specifically was wrong, and, you know, learning from it. So I think all of this past year, past few months, past, you know, it's been interesting because, you know, I have two daughters. They're, one is 20 months, one is 5 and a half. And we teach our kids to try to act in a respectful way, to apologize when you've done something wrong, what an apology looks like, learning from your mistakes. And it just seems really disappointing and disheartening that, you know, leaders in our state aren't doing the things that we teach our children.
My guest today is State Senator Stephanie Chang from District 1 in the Detroit area. We're going to continue our conversation with her in just a moment.
At the basic level, we have to treat each other with decency. We have to respect each other. We have to understand that, you know, words matter. What you say matters, especially as an elected official.
You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's get back into our conversation with Michigan State Senator Stephanie Chang. The Detroit Democrat made an emphatic speech on the Senate floor this week, calling out Majority Leader Mike Shirkey for continued use of sexist language. I think there's an assumption that politics is, in essence, a hardball game, and that any bruises that happen are sort of par for the course. But it did feel like there was a conversation going on maybe over the past 2 years in Lansing about the culture, especially about how women were treated. We've seen, you know, a senior member of the majority party censured and stripped of a committee assignment because of sexual harassment. We've seen repeated conversations about how the opposition party and the language that's used to talk to and about a sitting governor. Did those conversations just not happen?
Well, I mean, I think publicly there's a big public discussion about all of this. There have been some interpersonal, you know, one-on-one conversations. I've been in at least one of those, but I don't know whether it was about gender or race or other things. I know that there has been some learning on the part of some colleagues who have shown that they're listening. And I appreciate that. I don't think that that is everyone. And unfortunately, I don't think it has extended to our highest leaders. So I'm always hopeful that people can learn. I wouldn't have run for office if I wasn't an internal optimist. I think a lot of us are just feeling really disheartened right now. But, you know, we're here because we want to do good work. We want to try to improve the lives of Michiganders. We want to work in a bipartisan way. It's just getting harder and harder to do that when real issues aren't being taken seriously when it comes to race and to gender. I did co-lead a really great internal, you know, work group around harassment, and we came up with some really good recommendations. But I think that that is one piece of the much larger puzzle, which is how do we really, really grapple with issues of race and gender in our workplace and thereby the rest of the state, because we're elected representatives who are supposed to be, you know, setting a good example. And unfortunately, I don't think that we are right now.
One last question. Mike Shirky issued a written statement, quoting here, saying that he'd said some things in a conversation that aren't fitting for the role he's privileged to serve. And he said, "I own that." He said, "I have many flaws, being passionate coupled with an occasional lapse in restraint of tongue, or at least two of them. I regret the words I chose and apologize for my insensitive comments." What's your reaction?
Well, when I first saw that, you know, I appreciated the fact that his office put that out. His office has some good people that, you know, I think are genuinely trying to do a good job for the state of Michigan. It's clear from the hot mic comments from yesterday that there isn't actual regret, except for maybe some word choices. But the apology was not very specific. And in my floor speech yesterday and earlier today in my conversation with you, I mentioned that apologies do need to mention specifically what was wrong and like which parts of what he said did he think, you know, were wrong and what is he sorry for? I honestly don't know. And it's not clear from the statement and also from the hot mic comments. I think that we're all sort of doubting whether or not there is actual remorse there. So, you know, I hope that there can be some real learning here. I don't feel like that has happened so far, but, you know, I'm an optimist. I hope that we'll get to a place where, you know, we can really do some reflection and grow from this. I think it's going to take a lot of work, but I hope that we can do that.
The hot mic comments referring to what Majority Leader Shirky said to Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist yesterday, basically saying he wasn't really walking back anything.
That's great.
Stephanie Chang, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Democrats in Congress have become divided on a somewhat unexpected policy point: the immigration status of people seeking COVID stimulus payments. Michigan Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters are two of the 8 Democrats in the Senate who are supporting an amendment to the budget during last week's marathon voting session, and it would prohibit undocumented immigrants from receiving stimulus checks. We know there's a lot of uncertainty right now for immigrant families, especially Latino families, many of whom are continuing to live and work right on the front line of the COVID pandemic. With us to talk about the support systems that are available is Charo Ledon. She's the co-founder of Buenos Vecinos, a volunteer-led group in Washtenaw County. Charo, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April.
First of all, tell us a little bit about your work, about Buenos Vecinos and the community that you serve.
Well, Buenos Vecinos came about... We started when we did the health survey in the county back in 2014. And then we just kept working together because we need to. And so that's how we got started. Right now, we have been focusing, well, last year and for 3 years prior, we were focusing on working with the Latino English learners in Ipsy High School, doing academic support in social emotional learning curriculum. But when the pandemic hit, we sort of pivoted to helping the families of those students. And of course, the word gets around and it's lots of different people besides the parents of those students. And we've been helping the families with paying rent and bills, childcare, car insurance, because a lot of them, well, the majority of the ones that call me are undocumented and they don't get any unemployment, no stimulus, and they don't qualify for any assistance like food stamps or anything like that. So they're basically on their own to cover their expenses.
How are they getting by?
It's really like a miracle. Most of them have to choose what bill that they're going to pay. For a while, there was rent assistance, and that sort of came to a halt September 1st. And then what I can do is help them pay their bills. So the money they would have used for their bills, they can use to pay part of their rent. That probably won't cover all of their rent. A lot of them are behind on their rent. Some of them have faced eviction proceedings. And I think it was October 1st, there was some CARES Act money that came to assist with eviction prevention. But that ended December 30th, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. But those people were like on the brink of homelessness. If you were not to that edge of the cliff, they couldn't help you at all. And so one person in particular called me last week. They were able to help her, but now her apartment building is not going to renew her lease because she had this problem.
Because she was late on the rent.
Right. She couldn't pay her rent, and she finally did get it all paid, but now they won't renew her lease. So, it's not ideal to wait till they're in eviction proceedings to get help. Hopefully there's some money coming down the pike here, but it's not ready yet. And hopefully it will not require that close to the brink situation to get help.
When we talk about undocumented folks on the front lines, we're talking about people working in food processing, people working in hospitality and restaurants, agricultural industries. I mean, these are things that I think Americans would say that they can't really do without. What would you say, given what you know about people's financial needs that you just laid out, what is the strongest need in the community? Is it different kinds of assistance so that money can be used for rent? How would you describe it?
I think if people received help to get their rent paid, they would scrape by to cover the other bills, you know, like DTE or the water bill and so on. Like there's some single moms whose partners got deported that have to have childcare expenses that they can't cover so that they can go to work and make enough to pay the bills. And so childcare assistance would be useful, but primarily rent. Rent's what really worries them, because if you don't have a place to live, then all bets are off. I mean, everything else comes tumbling down.
The support that is available, you mentioned some of the state assistance payments. What's going on from the philanthropic world? Is there any place that you can steer people?
Well, so in terms of philanthropy, you know, everyone is out there asking for money. All of the nonprofits are in a bind. And money is not that readily available right now.
Yeah.
So we were fortunate that they were able to come up with some money to put out to help people.
Chara, can you tell us a little bit about some of the families you work with?
Sure. The families are, you know, from all over. Some speak some English, some not so much, which makes it hard to access some of the assistance if they call and the only voice they hear is in English. They're more likely to just hang up. But, you know, there's families with one parent that has documentation and one that doesn't. And in terms of the stimulus, if there's a mixed status family, like I'm describing, one parent has, you know, papers or is a citizen, for example, and the other one is not, it doesn't matter how many kids they have born here, they don't get the stimulus. They're excluded from the stimulus because of the one parent that does not have documentation. Mm. So that's really sad. Actually, it's embarrassing that we're doing that, really.
What does it mean in terms of family survival to not have that?
Well, I mean, the stimulus was proposed and, you know, given just so that people would have some relief from the crisis that they're in. It's not really going to cover all their bills, obviously. $600 doesn't, you know, it should be a lot more, but they don't get any of it. And so they're not getting the assistance that their next door neighbor is getting or their coworkers. And so it really is excluding people who are working hard. And just because they don't have documentation, they still have to eat and live and pay rent. And most likely they're working to create some food to be at the grocery store. Like people who milk cows, if they weren't working, there would be no milk at the store. So, you know, that's just one example. But back to the family, you know, there are single mothers. There are families that are several generations. For example, a couple, the wife's sister and her partner and all of their kids. It's not unusual to have a household with four parents, you know, two couples or grandparents or aunts and uncles. Many people in one household, lots of single mothers. Oftentimes they'll pair up to be able to afford rent.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people that have moved. They just could not make it here and they moved out of state to a cousin's house, couch surfing.
Mm.
That's one person in particular I talked to that happened. You know, and then some that have little children that can't really, the mom is home with the kids. Besides the ones that are in school remotely, they have little ones. And so the mom is home and then the dad is trying to get some work. So there's a variety. There's a wide variety. And it being winter, a lot of people work in lawn care or roofing, and that's not happening because of the weather. So right. It's harder in the wintertime. If it were summer, it's not so dire. But in the wintertime, it's extra hard.
Charo, could you tell us a little bit about what this work means to you personally?
Well, I like to help people. And when I was given the opportunity to learn, get trained to do barrier buster requests, it was like, it gave me purpose because I also was distressed, depressed, really, being at home and not being able to work. So this was uplifting for me to be able to help and help the community, be able to do something that helped other people, lots of people. And I don't see it letting up anytime soon. And even when COVID gets squashed somehow and people start going back to work, there's going to be psychological harm that we haven't even begun to consider or acknowledge. Because right now, people are just in survival. But once they start getting out of survival, that's when they're going to have time to fall apart, you know, emotionally. And so it's going to take a while. But I can't help it. I help people. That's what I do. That's what makes me tick. And I'm happy to do it.
I didn't mean to upset you. Thanks for telling us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, it's not upsetting. It's just I get emotional.
Sure.
People that know me know this about me. I have leaky faucets.
I feel like anybody who hasn't had good cries over the past 13 months is probably missing an organ or two.
Yeah.
Charo, we're coming out of a period when there really was no immigration debate as far as the federal government was concerned. Now the United States is within a place where there is more of a dialogue, but the political environment is still really charged, as we've seen. Is there something that you would hope people would keep in mind about this community as decisions are getting made?
Well, there's just lots of well-meaning, hardworking folks that are here because back in their country, things were not tolerable. I mean, who wants to leave their home to go elsewhere where it's cold and they don't speak the language and start from scratch? People don't take that decision lightly. They do it because the situation where they were was just not tolerable. And so they're here trying to make a better life for them and their kids. And they want to participate in this society. They really want to. But in some ways, they are prevented from doing so, like driver's licenses. I mean, that's one way that it keeps people from participating fully in the society. They can't get around. I mean, they take their life in their hands, going out to work or going out to wherever they need to go, driving without a license. And if they get pulled over, they could potentially get deported just for driving without a license. And so just that alone is a big issue. And we've been trying to get that resolved, but it's still there.
Charo Ladon is with us today. She is a co-founder of Buenos Vecinos. That's a volunteer-led group helping immigrants in Washtenaw County. Charo, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In just a moment, a short history of masks in Western medicine.
People have been wearing masks in some form, or, quote, avoiding the unclean, since at least Leviticus in the Old Testament.
We'll take a break first. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Prepare to double down. The CDC announced this week that wearing two masks or wearing a tight-fitting surgical mask is highly effective at preventing the spread of COVID-19. Wearing a mask as an effective tool against the spread of disease has become so common. It's funny to think that it's a social norm that did not exist in the United States just 1 year ago. That got us thinking about the history of masks for medical purposes. We happen to know a guy. Dr. Howard Markell is a professor and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, and he joins us now. Hi, Howard.
Hi, April. I'm so glad to be a guy, your guy. I've never been a guy before, so I'm really, that's delightful.
I got a guy for my furnace, I got a guy for my car, and a guy for my epidemiology. I think one of the first things that springs to mind is those long, beaky, goggled leather masks from the plague era of medieval Europe in the 1600s. Do you know, is that the first time we really saw face coverings used by medical professionals or healers?
Well, they were used in different ways. That's the most famous, those 1650s pictures of the plague doctors. But from Hippocrates well into the 19th century, people thought these epidemics like bubonic plague or cholera or whatever emerged from the local conditions, that the miasma, the pollution given off by rotting sewage and organic garbage and things like that, made Ann Arbor a potentially sick zone, but not Ypsilanti. And that's why to this day, local and state rights are baked into the Constitution when it comes to public health issues.
Wow.
People have been wearing masks in some form or, quote, avoiding the unclean since at least Leviticus in the Old Testament. Okay.
Wow.
And you'll see people like washing their hands or going to the bathroom far away from somebody or, you know, and what changes from, you know, 400 BC to say 1900 is that we no longer think infectious diseases is caused by a pollution of the atmosphere, but by a specific microbe. And that would require a very specific public health plan because every microbe infects and travels differently and spreads differently.
Do you know if those plague era masks served any function other than to just alert people that a plague doctor was in the vicinity?
They might have if there was the bubonic plague if the pneumonic plague of bubonic plague was raging. That is a form where the microbe doesn't just infect the lymph nodes. That's the buboes, these giant softball, hard, painful lumps, but they get into the lungs somehow, and then you can infect people casually, as you could with COVID by, you know, respiratory droplets. So technically, if you're wearing like a big beak mask and you're exposing people, it might cover some. It's how many layers of Swiss cheese, basically, are you putting over your nose and mouth? And that comes to why the CDC things are so interesting. Look at how badly people wear masks in the grocery store or wherever you go. Their noses are sticking out. Their mouths are on the side. I saw a guy smoking a cigarette through one. And so we don't have good mask hygiene. And that's why the more layers you put on, it makes common sense, the more likely you are to prevent contact with this stealthy infectious disease.
When did we start to see more systemic use of masks to prevent the spread of particles as an actual medical intervention?
Yeah. Well, as a social thing, this is kind of now. It's a 21st century phenomenon. But it came about in the era of first antiseptic surgery and then aseptic. So you may remember, before the 1850s, surgeons didn't even wash their hands. They wore bloodied frock coats, and they operated as quickly as they could because there wasn't even anesthesia. This is before 1845. As they advanced, they learned that if they washed their hands intensively with things like carbolic acid and their instruments and so on, they killed the germs and patients did better. But then they found out around the turn of the last century that if you did something called aseptic surgery, that you don't have any germs in the operating theater at all, that produced the best results for postoperative recovery. So that's why rubber gloves were developed and masks were developed. But masks were originally made, like if you look at a mask from 1910, if one even exists, it's made out of several layers, like 4 to 6 layers of gauze. So, gauze isn't exactly the most stealthy or industrial strong kind of barrier. And they were really kind of an icon of the surgeon, okay? But they were rarely brought out. They were brought out in some cities in the 1918-1919 flu pandemic, particularly Western cities like San Francisco, which actually had a law where you're
right.
Based. And they had thousands of scoff laws who met and said, we don't want to. And they all had to pay fines and things like that. And, we've had other, you can't find a series of public health edicts during a particular crisis that somebody in the population doesn't find very offensive to their way of life. And this is just how it's playing out now.
What kinds of, before we had the kind of medical grade masks that we do right now, what were some of the common things that people would use to make masks in past pandemics?
Oh, it's funny because they would make them even into fashion things. So there were ads in 1918 for chiffon masks for, females, and you'd look kind of like you were in the Alibaba and the Seven Thieves because you had this.
Like a Dance of the Seven Veils kind of mask. I got
you. Yeah. And they had other kinds of masks for men. They didn't have things like, statements on them. I don't recall that, but they had all different kinds of material. And don't forget, so the 1918-1919 pandemic where face masks were suggested, they weren't enforced in most places. But most masks were made by American Red Cross chapters, and they were basically 4 to 6 layers of gauze. But people are creative, which is kind of neat. I remember the New York Times a few months ago had a full page like a pattern, how to make a mask. And I thought, that's pretty cool.
I'm still waiting for my chiffon mask that I can wear over my surgical one.
It's not that big of a deal, and it helps a lot. So why wouldn't you do it? The great thing about living in the 21st century as opposed to the 14th century is we have all this knowledge and techniques and treatments and even preventions for this terrible infectious disease. So I think we need to avail ourselves with the science, with professionals, and move along accordingly. We still all have to play safe social distancing measures for now until the immunization process unrolls.
Howard, I remember seeing pictures from different countries in Asia, like Hong Kong, and I think China in the 90s, of people wearing masks in public in airports or shopping centers or markets. And I remember thinking, oh, how paranoid. Well, who's laughing now? Why is it that some Asian countries were such early adopters way before COVID?
Well, they often, in Southeast Asia, was often the origin site for many infectious diseases, particularly influenza, as well as SARS and a few other things. So there's a lot of people who are really close together, particularly on public transportation and so on. But they really have adopted it. There's no question that many Asian nations, China in particular, were early adopters of this, and they remain very true to that methodology.
Do you think that there will be a more general societal acceptance eventually to masks in Western countries during cold and flu season, just as a matter of course?
Well, I think it depends on the flu, and we may have corona seasons, by the way. We may have to take annual coronavirus. Oh. Well, I don't know. It's a good question. I think it's that's the polite thing to do, but particularly if it's not lethal and, you know, you just miss a couple of days of work. You know, don't forget, we're doing all these things today that some people object to, including face masks, because, you know, we're in the middle of a war. We're fighting a pandemic, the pandemic of our lives. So this is what we're focusing on now. But you may see in the future, a year from now or two, that different people in Ann Arbor or where have you wear masks during the winter months.
Dr. Howard Markell, professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan. Howard, thank you.
Thank you. So this is how your guy is going out, where, you know, there's a place you can buy your mask. And I know it.
He's my guy.
I'm the guy. Yeah. Just send us $5.
Thanks, Howard. It feels like every COVID story we've reported to you lately begins and ends with the acknowledgement that Michigan does not have anywhere near enough COVID vaccination doses to meet demand, or even to meet the need in priority groups. It's the same problem all across the country. USA Today reported this week that Pfizer, whose largest manufacturing plant is in Kalamazoo, is gearing up in hopes of making a significant reduction in the time it takes to crank out a batch of COVID vaccination doses. Elizabeth Weiss reported the story for USA Today, and she joins us now. Beth, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
How would you describe the pressures, market and otherwise, on Pfizer to increase production right now?
Oh, enormous. When I talked to chemical engineers, actually at the Kalamazoo plant, they said they have never experienced anything like this. One guy, he's a 40-year engineer. He's like, I just sat down on my living room couch and put my head in my hands and was thinking, how are we going to do this? There's so many moving parts. And what's interesting is the way that Pfizer did it and Moderna did it the same way is when they got their formulation for the vaccine, that was in a lab, and then they just scaled it on up and they said, okay, this made 100 doses. Now we need to make, millions. They scaled it up and they put it into place. They're actually doing it in three different plants because there are three very distinct portions of the manufacturing process. And they started out, it took 110 days per batch. They are on track to get that down to 60. And that sounds a little scary because you think, well, they shouldn't be speeding it up. But really what's happening there is that they were able, normally, if you're an engineer at a pharmaceutical company and they say, okay, we're going to make this vaccine, you say, great. And I'll come back to you in, 2 years, and I will have designed an entire factory that is perfectly efficient. And and 2 years from now, we'll build that factory and life will be good and we'll start making the vaccine. And in this case, they just started making the vaccine. And so as they are making it, they are figuring out how to do it more efficiently and swapping things out. I don't want to say on the fly because this is all such a heavily regulated area. I mean, FDA is in that factory making sure that everything they're doing is what comes out at the other end is exactly the same as it was the week before, but right. They are changing things.
So as you say, there are some things that they want to do to sort of refine and streamline just their factory process. But is there anything that's inherently different about production of the COVID-19 that makes this learning experience for Pfizer? Like what kinds of things are different than other vaccines that they've worked on?
Oh, well, the biggest one is that it's an mRNA. So it's this the messenger RNA. And RNA is this incredibly, it's pretty much a fragile molecule. Like this is not a robust molecule. If you go to the doctor and comes in a little vial and they have to add saline solution to increase the volume so they can give you the injection. And the instructions tell you to gently turn it's about the size of your thumb, the little vial a few times. Normally, if you're ever in a pharmacist's office, they shake things to mix them, but you have to be, RNA is delicate. And so the deal with RNA is to get it to go from the syringe into your bloodstream, into a cell, they have to encase it in a, it's lipids. They case it in a little ball of fat. I mean, a microscopic ball of fat. It's kind of like putting an M&M in the candy coating so it doesn't melt in your hand, that you want it to melt inside the cell. That is a really delicate process. And the engineer that I spoke with said, okay, so we knew how to do it in these little hockey puck sized mixers. So we bought hundreds of them and we lined them all up and we had all this tubing between them because we knew that worked and we just had to make vaccine. And over time, now they've realized, okay, now we know how we would build a mixer that did exactly what these little tiny hockey puck sized ones, which are meant for the lab, how we can do that industrial scale. And so now they're building something that can take over from those 100 mixers and do it in one, and it's much more efficient. So those are the kinds of things where when they scaled up, sometimes they didn't scale up the way any engineer in their rational mind would do. They scaled up so that it worked and it produced the same thing. And then they came back and said, okay, now how do we do it a little more reasonably?
Can you remind us when Pfizer makes what we might say is one batch, whether it takes 110 days to fully develop it or 60 days, how many doses do the people administrating the vaccine get out of that?
So it depends on where you are in the process, because there's three different very specific points. But one batch, it can be 20 to 40 million doses coming out of one batch. And it's fascinating because it goes in these very high-tech plastic bags that are about the size of a grocery bag. I mean, one of those can have trillions of these microscopic RNA molecules. And then that goes to the next place, and then they encase them in the fat globules. And so each of these bags, as it's moving through, and you think these bags are, talk about worth their weight in gold. These bags are frozen down and they're specially transported onto the next plant. And so for each time, I think originally the first one, it's they've got trillions of RNA, then they get to 20 to 40 million. By the end, when they've got one batch coming through, I think they're down to 10 to 20 million doses per run through.
Given the lead role that Pfizer's vaccine is playing in the national vaccination effort, I mean, yes, Moderna, yes, Johnson & Johnson, but Pfizer has really been a big leg in this tripod. How much could an efficiency like this, if they can do it, how much would it potentially speed things up?
Well, it could almost cut in half the amount of time it takes to produce the vaccine. So the problem, and the important thing to remember here, and I think we're hearing a lot of governors angry that they don't have more vaccine. The thing to remember is, so the vaccine that is going into arms today, Pfizer and Moderna started those and Moderna didn't talk to us, so we don't know their timeline, but I'm going to presume it's about the same. Those batches of vaccine were started around Halloween. So it is speeding up, but it's not instantaneous. So in 2 months' time, the batches that are started today will only take 60 days, but the batches that were started 110 days ago, they took 110 days. And so it will speed it up. So the United States, we had purchased 400 million doses between Pfizer and Moderna. We've upped that by 200 million. So we'll get 600 million all told. That's enough for 300 million people. So that's good. How quickly will we get that? That's math we're still trying to work out. It's like an algebra problem where we don't have some of the numbers to plug into it, partly because Pfizer and Moderna are being quiet about how much they're actually producing, and partly because the federal government, I think, is still trying to get a handle on exactly when things will come.
Elizabeth Weiss is a reporter for USA Today. Beth, thank you very much for your time.
You're so welcome.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.